South Dakota braces for bird flu. From SDPB, today is Thursday, March 27th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, when the H5N1 virus infiltrates a commercial poultry barn, the consequences are devastating. Now the virus is showing up in dairy cattle, barnyard cats, and domestic sheep. So far, cases of human infection have been low, but viruses, as we all know by now, are smart. They mutate. They find new ways to take hold and survive. The federal government provides assistance to farmers charged with depopulating flocks, but that's not a sustainable business model. Vaccines might help, but they remain controversial. We'll spend the hour on bird flu basics. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The weather is warming up here in South Dakota, and that means that some South Dakota residents who migrated out of state for the winter are returning, or just flying through. Migratory flocks can bring highly pathogenic avian influenza to the region, especially in our wetland areas. The virus spreads easily and quickly, and it can be deadly, not only to wildlife, but to domestic animals as well. We're going to spend this hour going over some bird flu basics. Beth Thompson is South Dakota State Veterinarian. She says it's only a matter of time before South Dakota is dealing with more cases. Last year, she coordinated efforts to track the state's first bird flu outbreak in dairy cattle. We asked her what to expect this year. The news is, none of it seems good to me, including that they found in the UK in sheep now as well. So how fast is this story developing and changing? First of all,
yeah, and that's that news that came out in the last couple of days about that sheep over in the UK, concerning, but probably not surprising. Mm-hmm. Again, if you look at the number of species that have been affected across the United States, just looking in the wild animals, we've had wild cats, bears, all of the raccoons and rodents and skunk. Again, probably not altogether surprising, because whether it's here in the United States or on other continents, our environment is contaminated with this virus. And those animals that are out in that environment ongoing have a risk of becoming infected.
We think of it as a bird flu, that I'm getting my mind around the fact that it's, although the name might be this, it certainly is not restricted to birds at all. Do we know the origin of this and how it is transmitted from animal to animal?
So this specific species of avian influenza was first detected in Asia back in the mid-90s. And so, to your point, we call it avian influenza, or, we name these influenzas usually by the species that they're most likely to infect. Influenzas are smart viruses, though, and they can infect other species. We've had canine influenza. Of course, we think about influenza and hogs, and then human influenza. But there are a whole number of other species that seem to have one or two types of influenza that they most likely will get. It did start mainly in birds, and that's where it was picked up back in the mid-90s. It was concerning in Asia because it was affecting poultry and killing poultry. But there have always been human cases that have been associated with it.
How is it transferred?
For the most part, with poultry, it's the close contamination bird to bird is how it spreads. Birds can spread it through respiratory secretions, through their feces, a number of different ways that the virus is spread bird to bird. When we start talking about other mammals, that's a really good question, whether it's probably the same way. We would be very concerned if we started seeing this influenza virus spread human to human. So that is something that, agencies like the CDC watch very closely.
Mosquito-borne at all?
I do not have any information, any research on that, but that is a very good question. Mosquitoes, biting flies, some other viruses are spread that way, so it's a possibility, Lori.
All right. What do we know, since we've had some time to study this, about the virus's structure or its composition? What makes the mortality so high for birds?
For birds, it does. I mean, it targets certain pieces of their genetics. And when it infects a flock or infects maybe a single bird, it quickly takes over that physiological system and causes the death. So the high mortality, high morbidity of this virus in poultry, in all poultry species, really. We're talking about turkeys here in South Dakota, but also chickens, whether they're laying eggs or they're the chickens that we eat. It's the high mortality that makes this virus very concerning.
You know, you mentioned you'd be very concerned if it was transferring from person to person, from human to human. How often are updates about the virus coming through? I mean, when I think of something from the 90s, it seems like, not no big deal, but it seems like it's not novel, right? And we've all been through a novel virus, and we know what that can be like. It seems like we understand it. And yet, it doesn't seem like we can stop it or treat it or prevent it in any way that you would expect, that I would expect as a layperson, we would be able to do by now. What am I missing in how this works?
Preparation for speaking with you, I pulled up the CDC website from today, and what they're reporting is 70 human cases of avian influenza in the United States since April of 24. The detail of these 41 cases, so 41 of 70, were associated with exposure to sick dairy cows, and 26 were associated with exposure to avian influenza virus-infected poultry. So that seems to be, at least at this point in time, the virus hasn't shifted or drifted so that it's spreading person to person. It's the workers that work with the infected dairy or the infected poultry, for the most part, are the ones that are becoming sick themselves. I think the risk to you or I, because we're not around those infected poultry or the infected dairy, our risk still remains low.
Which gets me to this idea of, we all know that a producer does not want to depopulate a flock. We know the expense of that, even though there are some government programs to help mitigate the loss. We know it's not what they want to do. But also, these people are in charge of containing the virus in some very important ways through biosecurity. Tell me a little bit about what people in the industry are doing on the daily basis to prevent a flock from being infected, but then also, if a flock is infected, to contain that virus and minimize the damage.
Part of the definition of biosecurity, at least in my brain, is you keep all of the viruses and other pathogens out of the barn. And at the same time, to your question, when a barn becomes infected, you want to make sure you're not moving it out of that barn into other areas where there might be poultry or other livestock. So our farmers on a day-to-day basis have different levels of biosecurity, different things that they can do to achieve those goals. For example, keeping visitors away from the live animals, whether it's poultry or livestock, making sure that vehicles coming on the farm have been cleaned, making sure that if somebody does go into the barn or into the area where the livestock are, that they're not coming from a place that has infection or has other pathogens. When we talk about poultry and that concern about the migratory waterfowl, we want to make sure that none of those birds, or really any other, now that we know that other mammals can be infected, making sure that rodents aren't getting into the barns in addition to any of those other birds. It's a multifaceted and a very complex to keep biosecurity high, especially on our poultry facilities now, and especially now, this time of the year, when we've got migratory waterfowl starting their path across South Dakota.
Yeah. sometimes when I'm having these conversations, it doesn't seem like a sustainable system to me. Does something need to change in how we address avian influenza?
There are different paths that we have been discussing over the course of the last couple of years, probably in earnest in the last 6 months to a year, one of those being vaccine. As we all know, human vaccine for influenza, sometimes it works really well and sometimes it doesn't. But it is another tool that veterinarians and farmers can add. It's not the silver bullet, though. So in addition to that, if we switch back to rodents, wild waterfowl, other things that might be carrying these viruses, making sure that they're not entering these barns, draining possibly some of the water that is around some of these barns so you're not attracting, whether it be additional birds or other mammals, to actually switch paths quickly is going to be difficult. Because going back to the vaccine discussion, that affects international trade. And so that those steps have to be taken very carefully and thoughtfully, not only for poultry producers here in the Midwest, but across the United States.
It affects international trade in the sense that how exactly?
Our trade agreements are set up so that trading partners want to make sure they are not getting product and or live animals, eggs, anything like that, that have been exposed to or have avian influenza. A vaccine has to be carefully built so that vaccinated birds can be differentiated from infected birds. And that's through a technology, it's known as DIVA technology, that can help you differentiate between the two. So that becomes a concern. And to be quite frank, you know, some of these trade questions come down to politics too. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the political science outweighs the actual science of using vaccine in mm-hmm. poultry in the United States.
Is there the research that needs to happen into a vaccination or into a vaccine development or in another area that might address the problem? I guess, what is the big picture regarding research?
Yeah, big picture. I think there are 5 vaccines out there for use in poultry. Without getting into the details, most of those are, the data is in chickens. And so it would be good to have research if we talk about turkeys, if we talk about some of the game birds that we raise here in South Dakota. They have not been approved for use in the United States, like back to that trade question, but mm-hmm. there are vaccines out there. Additional research is always good, understanding that the virus continues to change. And so to have additional information on that virus as it shifts and drifts, would be good to have. Yes, absolutely.
How bad is it going to be this year? What are people bracing for?
So in the last, 30 days, there have been 16 commercial sites across the United States. There have not been any detections here in South Dakota, but across the United States, and little over 2 million birds have been depopulated. The area of the United States right now that's being hit is Ohio, Pennsylvania, Indiana, Illinois, kind of that strip across the midsection below the Great Lakes. I don't doubt we're going to see cases here in South Dakota. Iowa had a large pullet site that was affected within the last 10 days. So those birds are starting to make their way back through. The question becomes whether or not they decide to main path through South Dakota, through the prairie potholes, or if they're going to move up further east from us. I watch the snow geese, especially mm-hmm. on their migratory path.
Are there advantages to having, not necessarily smaller operations, but dividing flocks into smaller buildings? Are the facilities too big, or are they doing too many things at once that cause for greater loss?
That is a really good question, and I think it comes down to the husbandry involved. So going back to the numbers for the last 30 days, there have been 50 approximately backyard flocks across the United States that have been affected. And that is a bigger picture. It's not just the Illinois, Indiana, Ohio. If we talk about backyard flocks, that's all the way from Oregon to Maine and down to Florida. New York City has shut down their live bird markets. I think some of those are coming back online now, but the smaller flocks are affected too. So it might be an answer in certain parts of the country, but I don't know if that's a big picture, the answer for this situation.
Right. Anything that you wish you knew or wish you could do? Is there a magic bullet out there? You said it's not a vaccine. It's not a magic bullet. Is there, in your mind, a magic bullet?
I don't believe there is a magic bullet. I think vaccine would be a great help to what we do if it's the right vaccine. But overall, this virus is truly entrenched in waterfowl. Our environment is contaminated. More and more, we're seeing additional, you know, to the sheep in the UK, additional mammals that are affected. We need to think through what that means long term for the United States, our poultry industry, and the rest of our livestock industry. So we need to continue to communicate with each other on this. It's truly something that the world has not seen before.
That's South Dakota's state veterinarian, Dr. Beth Thompson. Now, every time a human is infected with the virus has a chance to fight for its survival by mutating. Right now, the risk to people is low. We reached out to Dr. Jill Cruz to understand those risks. Cruz is a member of the on-call with the Prairie Doc team.
When people do get it, it could be no symptoms or very mild illness, just upper respiratory symptoms, cough, cold, runny nose. Or it could lead to severe infection, such as pneumonia, and even up until death. So it can be very severe in some people. Thankfully, it hasn't happened all that frequently in people thus far, but still something to consider and think about, especially in our state where we have lots of birds. And right now we're hitting the migration season of all the geese coming through the area, as well as our animals, livestock animals, since cows can get this.
Yes, many workers, for example, who work with animals, farmers and workers are often the ones who are impacted. How are you screening for it in your office if somebody calls in or comes in?
So we are testing for, we can test for influenza, and it will tell us if it's influenza A or B. To test specifically for bird flu, that swab would need to be sent on for additional subtyping to see if it's the H5N1, which is the high infectious strain of avian influenza, or the H7N2, which is the low infectious type of avian influenza.
And when would you consider doing that, especially if the symptoms were mild?
Basically, we are subtyping patients who are in the hospital. That, where we're really concerned, you know, are they potentially having that more severe case where they have the pneumonia or they're at higher risk for this because they already have current lung situation? So right now, what I understand in Brookings is we're subtyping people in the hospital with influenza A to see if it's avian influenza or not. In the clinic, we're just saying, is it A or B? And if it's mild, we're not as concerned or subtyping for that specifically.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about prevention for people and start with unpasteurized milk.
So that is a way that you can catch this because pasteurization kills pathogens. So unpasteurized milk, if you're getting milk from a cow that was infected with avian influenza, you could potentially get this. The other way would be to coming in contact with animals who were infected. So any secretions from them, any saliva. As you know, cows are not the neatest when it comes to oral secretions, very easy to come in contact with their saliva if you've worked with cows. But again, working with chickens, any poultry, if you're coming in contact with their secretions, that's where this virus is transmitted.
How about, you know, backyard bird feeders, turkey hunting, pheasant hunting? I mean, anything that we need to be concerned about our interaction with birds themselves?
I would say these are all fairly low risk at this point. If you see an animal that's behaving abnormally and seems like it's sick, then I would avoid interacting with that animal. I know hunters pretty much know what is normal animal behavior, and right. if something just doesn't seem right, I would not interact with that animal at all. But again, just good hand hygiene and making sure that you're staying safe. The numbers that you're running into, you know, is probably fairly low risk, but it's not zero. So just using good judgment and common sense of if something feels off or something doesn't seem quite right, try to avoid putting yourself in that position.
That's Jill Cruz with the On Call with the Prairie Doc team. Catch the show on Thursdays at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB-TV1 and on the Prairie Doc Facebook page. It also airs right here on your radio on Sundays at 6 a.m. Central, 5 Mountain, and again at 1 p.m. Central, noon Mountain. Up next, Jason Ramsdell takes us into the poultry industry. He's the general manager at Dakota Layers. As we continue to understand avian influenza in the state, to animals, people, and the economy. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're spending this hour talking about the basics of bird flu, with an eye on how the spread of the virus can devastate flocks of chickens and turkeys. In large commercial operations, if the virus gets in, millions of birds could be at risk, since the federal government requires the depopulation of infected flocks, including healthy animals. That is difficult for the farmers as well, and not just because of the economic gut punch. I spoke with Jason Ramsdell, general manager at Dakota Layers.
So yeah, Dakota Layers here in South Dakota, we have started in around 2000. This farm houses, on our main farm, we have 1.3 million hens. We have 5 barns of cage-free egg laying and 4 barns of conventional cages. We built a free-range farm in Brookings County that right now houses 80,000 birds that are in a cage-free environment, but then also have doors that they can go outside to a pasture area to be free-range birds. And then we house our corporate office and staff here in Flandreau, South Dakota, and then we also have a pullet farm south of Flandreau, which we bring baby chicks in and raise them till 15 weeks that we're able to supply our layer farms with the pullets for the needed birds out there.
So one thing I found interesting when I was looking into your operation was just how much consumer choice there is. You know, I can go in the grocery store and I can look at the details of what kind of egg I'm getting, the price for it, and I can make decisions based on what I want the egg to be. I thought that was fascinating. A lot of consumer transparency, really, I guess I would call it. What do you call it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely consumer transparency. And we, you know, we like to do what our consumers want us to do and do it better than they would expect us to do it as far as raising the birds or providing safe quality food. But we, you know, the consumers do have a lot of interest in, you know, some consumers want the cheapest egg they can get, which we want to provide that through a conventional egg where they're in cages. But then, you know, the consumers also want cage-free or free-range and added enhancements to the egg itself, whether it's increased vitamin in the feed or nutrients. So, you know, we want to produce what the consumer wants, and we want to show them that we're doing what they want us to do and exceeding what their expectations would be. So we're definitely transparent in the way of how we treat our birds and raise our birds and how we produce the product for them in the end to buy at a grocery store.
So from a biosecurity standpoint, do you brace at certain times of year with an operation at a certain location to say now we have to up our biosecurity, or is it all 100% keep virus out 24/7? 365.
Yeah, it's very difficult to try to heighten your biosecurity at any given time. As you know, a lot of the migration of this waterfowl happens at night, and depending on the winds and depending on the weather, could change in a snap of a finger. So we kind of keep our biosecurity as tight as we can and as high as we can year round. We've at our farm here in South Dakota have been hit 2 different times with the bird flu. One was in May of 2015, so it was a spring migration. The other one was in December of 22, which was wintertime. There was snow on the ground and there wasn't any birds migrating. So it's kind of trying to keep that biosecurity up year round is our plan that we always try to hit. And that goes from, you know, we have a front gate where we monitor people that are coming in and we ask questions, make sure they haven't been to any bird facilities or any other animal livestock facilities. And if they have, we stop them there with our front gate attendant and turn them around. We disinfect feet and tires as they come into the area and just kind of trying to control and keep the least amount of foot traffic off our farm that's unneeded. We have our corporate office close by that we help host meetings in that so that we don't need to bring outside people out to the farm if not needed. And then, of course, you know, every day that somebody has to go into the barn or into the layer barns, which is every day, you know, we have a bio room, we call it, that people come and only people that are going into the barns use this area, and they'll take their clothes and put them in the locker that they came in with. They'll shower. And then they'll put clothes on that we have washed on site, whether it's scrubbed or clothes they brought for us to leave there. So that when they're going into the chicken barns, you know, they're as clean as they can be after a shower and clean clothes that were washed on site and left on site. Mm. And same thing when they leave, they shower out and put their daily clothes back on that they came in with. Because if we do have something here, we don't want to take it anywhere else either. So we want to make sure we're protecting the other areas around us as well.
Yeah. How devastating is it and has it been for you when the flu gets in?
Yeah, it's extremely devastating, you know, from the thought of having to kill all your birds on site and the labor that goes into that and the mentality of people when they're having to kill all these birds, you know, that's a tough deal to deal with. But then even after that process is completed and we have killed all the birds, you know, we have a lot of families that work for us and a lot of people that, you know, are making a living off working for us and providing for their family. And so knowing that we don't have any birds to produce an egg to sell, which means there's no jobs available for these people, you know, it's very devastating that we have to think about that as well. But, you know, we try to keep everybody employed until we get our chickens back. The last two times we've done that, a lot of minor projects, you know, people have to change their daily job duties and do other things that to keep them getting a paycheck to the point where we can get chickens back, which takes anywhere from 3 to 5 months to get your first flock back. And then to get fully populated could take upwards of 2 years to get fully populated back. So to getting back to full strength of production takes quite a while, and it's devastating on everybody involved with that side of it.
Yeah. So when you look at 2015 or a previous experience, can you quantify it all? Because I know the federal government provides some financial assistance per bird, but can you quantify by percentage or, like, you know, how do you explain to people what kind of a hit this is for an operation?
Yeah, the federal government will they essentially pay for what the cost it is to kill the birds, to dispose of them, and then to clean the area, and they pay and reimburse that exact price of that part of it. They pay for the birds as well, but it's something like on those times was like 40 cents on the dollar, 40% of the actual cost. And there is no business interruption payment. So they don't pay for, you know, if you have 1 million birds and getting 80,000 dozen eggs a day, you know, there's no payment for what you lost on what, you know, being able to sell eggs and provide the company an income to be able to pay for employees at that time too. So, you know, they pay for the cleanup and disposal and the exact cost of that, and about 40% of the cost of what the bird would provide you over its life. But it's the long-term effect of having to go a year without normal business income and still try to provide jobs for employees until you're able to get back to the full production side.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to overstate this, but the psychological toll of the uncertainty, if you have to be the person who does the work of destroying a flock or depopulating, plus losing your job or being worried about losing your job, plus every single day the price of eggs is in the news. I mean, you got to have some stressful days. Let's put it that way. This is a high stress job in some ways.
Yeah, it's a very rewarding job, but there are instances like this where we're concerned with that does make it very stressful thinking about what's going to be there tomorrow. You know, because at any moment the lights can turn off and not sure what's going to happen, you know, and as far as if we get bird flu again, that definitely puts some stress on everybody's mind and in all of, for sure, egg production industry, you know, everybody's thinking of that.
Yeah.
So that part is stressful.
So what's the next breakthrough? We're talking a little bit this hour about the possibility of vaccines, but that's not a magic pill. What are the, you know, what's your viewpoint on vaccination against bird flu?
Yeah, I mean, that is the way to fight this virus, is vaccinating the birds at a young age to help give them protection against avian influenza. I'm hopeful that the federal government can see that the egg industry, the egg layers, are wanting this vaccine to protect our flock, because we don't want an entire flock to have to be killed, which only decreases the supply of eggs and in turn causes a shortage of eggs and usually a higher price. We want to be able to have this vaccine to be able to use it and provide the protection for our birds so that we can continue on a 365-day basis a year of providing eggs all the time and not be worrying about if we get bird flu and we have to kill all our birds, what do we do for jobs of people in our company? And what do we do to provide the eggs to other people, to consumers? So we're hopeful that a vaccine will be allowed in the egg laying industry, and hopefully before too long, before it gets back again and gets really bad with the amount of avian flu that could be spread throughout the egg industry.
So is it possible to allow a vaccine in the laying industry and not broilers? I mean, can you differentiate that, or is there a tension between the two?
Well, I think there should be a way to differentiate it. Right now, it's considered U.S. poultry, which includes broilers, turkey, meat birds, and egg layers all as one whole. But if you look at, for instance, the cattle industry, there's the meat cattle and there's the dairy cattle, and they're completely separate. They're two different types of cows. I mean, our birds are all different types of birds. The broiler bird is a different type of chicken than the layer chicken is. And so I'm hopeful that they can also differentiate that and allow the egg industry that wants this vaccine to be able to use it and show that the broiler industry is not using it to protect their export markets and be able to show on paperwork that even though the layer industry is maybe using vaccines, it doesn't mean, or that the broiler industry is not using it.
Sure. Any final thoughts of days ahead, things that you want consumers to understand, things that you want the congressional delegation to understand, any messages to leave us with?
Yeah, I think the main thing is, you know, that in the egg laying industry, our birds, we keep them for around 100 weeks of egg laying, and they start laying eggs around 20 to 25 weeks old. So that's almost 2 years of a schedule that I have planned out for just one flock. And so when I have 9 barns that I have to put in rotation in a 2-year span, you know, I have 5 years planned out for my flocks. And in turn, if I get bird flu and have to kill them all at once, it's impossible to bring them all back online at the same time. And so the supply, as fast as it goes away in a time like this with avian influenza, makes it very difficult to get it back in a short amount of time. It takes a long time to get that production back, and it's little by little. With the extent of the length these birds lay eggs, makes it difficult to ramp up and provide the same amount of supply in a quick amount of time, compared to how fast we can lose it.
Yeah. Doesn't sound particularly sustainable to me. as a business model long term, that's a tough factor to have to factor in.
To continue to have to fight something like the avian influenza, knowing that at any moment we could lose our entire flock and take another year and a half to get it back, is a very difficult business model to continue by. And that's why, you know, I'm hopeful that we can figure something out in the federal government to allow vaccines And there's already proven vaccines used and studied in other locations, other countries, that show that it, there's like 99% of the birds survive against it when challenged with it. So to protect our flocks, I'm hopeful that vaccines will be coming on the table at some point.
Jason Ramsdell is general manager at Dakota Layers. After the break, dozens of outdoor cats in rural South Dakota have died after exposure to avian influenza. Russ Daly with the SDSU Extension shares his research after the break. You're in the moment on Listener Supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. In addition to poultry and cattle, there is another common critter on the farmyard who is susceptible to bird flu. A study from the SDSU Extension is tracking flu deaths in South Dakota's outdoor cats. Russ Daly is the Extension veterinarian and professor in the Veterinary and Biomedical Sciences Department at SDSU. He's also a state public health veterinarian for the South Dakota Department of Health. And he's one of the leaders of a study. He joined me from SDPB's Janine Basinger studio with an update on his research.
At Brookings at SDSU, we have a diagnostic laboratory that takes care of detecting animal disease issues. And one of the things we've really been dealing with a lot in the past couple years already during this most current outbreak is high path avian influenza. And so the main problem with high path avian influenza is in its name, you know, it affects the birds. So where we've been affected in South Dakota pretty profoundly has been with chicken and turkey farms, especially turkey farms. High path avian influenza causes some very dramatic mortality and some very dramatic problems in those birds. So that's something that our poultry producers have been dealing with for the past couple years. We had a really interesting twist with the influenza virus, and that's kind of a common theme with influenza viruses, is there's always these interesting twists. We noticed it in dairy cattle, and we've had seven farms in South Dakota, not any lately, but we've had farms, cattle affected with this germ. It doesn't profoundly affect those cows as it does the turkeys. It causes them to be sick and drop their milk production for a while, and then they get better. But at about the same time we were seeing this, we had reports of cats becoming ill around dairy farms, not so much in South Dakota, but in other parts of the country. And, you know, somebody tested those cats and found that they had been infected with this same virus that's affecting the cattle and the turkeys. And so we've documented a few of those cases here in South Dakota.
Campbell County, Lake County, Brookings County. Do I understand the research correctly?
Yep. Those would be cases that veterinarians send into our Animal Disease Research and Diagnostic Laboratory. Okay. And that lab is meant to help veterinarians diagnose and help them help their clients with figuring out what these animal disease issues have been. And so we did some outreach. I'm the extension veterinarian at SDSU, so we put out some outreach on our website about those three cases that we had initially at the diagnostic lab. And since then, we've had a few other counties become affected, or cats in those counties, I should say, have become documented with them too. So
counties? Yeah.
Gregory, Brule, and Falk.
Okay.
And so it's kind of, you know, all over the place. It's not. And that's what we see with influenza. It's just all over the state, all over the country.
2025? Recently? You said not too recently. Are we talking about 2024 cases? Is that a relevant question, first of all?
Well, it kind of is. It gets to the currency, you know, of how what's going on.
Yeah.
And so it's been within the last couple months, I think, that we've had definitely had the most of them reported. I think it's important in that it illustrates how the virus is changing, you know. A year ago at this time, if you would have told me that high path avian influenza was going to kill cats, it just would have been, what are you talking about? And now it's become fairly well established in the veterinary community.
All right. So when we talk about cats, some of these cases, as I was reading your research, you know, think of a rural barn cat, 20 cats out there, and someone might come out and half of them are gone.
Yeah.
How is this showing up? Tell me, paint a picture for me beyond what I just said about how people are discovering this is a problem.
Well, what we've seen in South Dakota is, like you mentioned, the typical South Dakota farm cat population, where, you know, you have quite a few of them out in your outbuildings, and some of them are kind of tame, and some of them you're not able to handle, and you're feeding them and kind of taking care of them. So when we interview the producers who have had these problems, they will oftentimes notice that they've found a cat or two that are deceased, and they were perfectly, you know, fine and healthy before that. Then they will notice other things in the cats, and so the cats might be acting slow, they might be acting, have some incoordination, kind of wobbly. When they're, you know, close to the end, they will start to have seizures and have some neurologic signs, so some twitching and real problems referable to the nervous system. And that's the thing that we get a little concerned with, because we also have rabies in South Dakota. Mm-hmm. And so those signs in those cats that are affected can look a lot like rabies. So we've got to check those situations out for both of those diseases.
All right. So if I'm interacting with a cat, what do I have to do to protect myself to make sure that I'm not exposing myself to either the high path avian influenza or rabies? Help me figure out my role as a person, as a human interacting with cats.
What we're understanding so far is that we haven't been able to see that these sick cats have transmitted influenza to people. Now, there are some other situations in other states, and that it kind of is suspicious, but nothing's really been, you know, documented yet. But it behooves us to assume that could happen, and so we really want to be careful when working with these cats. And, you know, to be honest, the hands-off approach is the safest thing for us. And if it is rabies, or if it is high path avian influenza, our treatment options and our ability to get those cats over that problem is pretty limited anyway. So, you know, being real cautious in the first place about not handling them. If you do have to, then think about what we consider biosecurity things for working with any animals. You know, wearing some latex gloves, wearing an old coat that you can wash and not wear around other animals or other people, for that matter. Maybe even dig out the face mask that you had during the COVID time. So just being really careful about that possibility of transmitting that virus from the cats to us.
And you just said a year ago you didn't think this would be spread to cats. So there, I guess that leads me to believe there are question marks about how it might impact other, you know, dogs, raccoons, possums, and people.
Yep. Yeah, it's been noticed in other mammals, you know, like you mentioned, the raccoons and skunks and things like that. Those are harder for us to diagnose because people don't usually, you know, send them into the lab on their own.
But you wouldn't find multiple, most likely.
No, you wouldn't notice.
20 possums aren't going to show.
Right, right, right. So I think it really illustrates to us that you know, this virus is changing, you know, and in ways that we can't really predict. So that use of caution around animals you suspect with problems. And by all means, if you think there's a problem in your birds, you know, backyard poultry have been affected with this too. So if you think there's a problem with your birds or your animals, contact your veterinarian and figure out the best next steps.
All right. So for people who haven't lived rural and don't understand kind of the role of a farm cat, there are questions about, well, can you vaccinate? Why do you need them in the first place? What help people understand a little bit about what the role cats play on a farm?
Yeah, well, traditionally cats have been the rodent experts, right? You know, to take care of the rats and the mice that are around. And so you have some cats around the farm, and cats, if we don't get them taken care of with being spayed and neutered, they're going to reproduce. And then you have the situation where you have 10 or 15 or maybe even 20 cats around. Yeah. I'll be honest with you too, though. You know, the more you talk to, and I know this from growing up on a farm myself too, is they kind of play a little bit of a, you know, they're kind of wild, but they're companion animals too. You know, you might not be friends with all 20 of them cats, but those cats, but but a couple of them pretty nice and come up and you know, rub on you and let you pet them. Others, you know, would just soon bite you and run away. But there's that too. So they're kind of a part of the, I guess, the barnyard ecology of what we have in rural America.
Every farm kid's life has a good farm cat story.
Yeah, and you talked about vaccination. You know, a lot of farmers will, you know, get the rabies and the distemper in the cats that they can catch anyway, and make sure that they're doing what they can, and they feed them and do get them spayed and neutered too, because they want to take care of them, the ones they can catch anyway.
But I can't vaccinate for this influenza.
Right, there isn't a flu vaccine for cats or birds yet, and there's a lot of work being done on that, and so hopefully someday soon.
So then the idea is that these cats are most likely or possibly catching a duck, or they're catching some kind of bird, and that's
right.
How they're getting exposed.
That's what we gather from the cases that we worked on here in South Dakota. Anyway, now there are other cases around the country where it's been documented that the cats have eaten raw pet food, you know, sometimes available commercially, or mm-hmm. drank milk, you know, from an infected dairy. We haven't seen that in these South Dakota cases, but the common denominator with a lot of them is that they're close to wetlands where there are a lot of birds, you know, and we know that there's a lot of wild birds affected with avian influenza, and so it's more likely that these cats, you know, when they were out hunting or coming across a bird that was deceased from high-path avian influenza, that's how they picked it up and caught it.
Yeah. All right. Any action steps?
Monitor, you know, keep an eye on those populations. If you have your special house cat, maybe, you know, that you're really fond of, make sure that, you know, maybe this is the time that we keep them indoors. I would say also that not here in South Dakota, but other places, they have noticed indoor cats becoming infected with this too. So they're not necessarily safe from it, but the less we can expose those cats to, you know, the wild birds and the outdoors, the better off it is for them as far as the influenza goes.
Anything else you want to say in general about the influenza in turkeys or chickens or pheasants or anything else that you're seeing in South Dakota right now? How worried are you for this year, for 2025?
Oh, I'm worried, yeah. I guess that this isn't, I know this isn't anything that's going to go away anytime soon. And what we see is these ups and downs. You know, we'll have months where we don't have any problems. And then when we have the migratory patterns of the birds coming through, that's when we seem to see the problems. I'm worried for, you know, all the animals that can be affected for sure, but really worried for poultry producers, you know, and our dairy farmers, because, you know, a lot of them are doing everything they can biosecurity-wise to keep it out, but it's still coming in somehow. And so, you know, the sustainability of those farms is something that worries me too.
Yeah. Any cause for hope?
Well, vaccines, you know, now vaccines are tricky. You know, we have to change our human flu vaccine every year because the virus changes. So I'm cautiously optimistic that something will get developed that way. We need to get that figured out, because one of the reasons we don't vaccinate poultry or don't want to is because then that affects our exports. We can't tell other countries that, oh, these are just vaccinated birds, they're not infected birds. So we've got to get that figured out, and then I think everybody will be better off.
All right. Lots to talk about in the future, but Professor Russ Daly, thank you so much for this update. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Russ Daly is a professor at South Dakota State University and a state public health veterinarian for the South Dakota Department of Health. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. We are going to continue to cover the story of avian flu in South Dakota. Tune in Monday for thoughts on creating sustainable local food systems intended to support what some are calling inherent vulnerabilities in our commercial ag models. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. I'm Lori Walsh. We thank you for listening.